Hello everyone, thank you for coming. My name's Cam Sander and I'm one of the organisers of the Real Media Project. Just to tell you a little bit about who we are, we've been accused of being an NGO already, but we're just a handful of independent journalists who have funded this via a small pot of funding from the Network for Social Change and out of our own pockets. The reason that we started the Real Media Project is because we've wanted to confront and tackle some of the largely unsaid but hugely harmful problems with the media. Certainly one of the things that made us challenge this now is the unrelenting coverage of UKIP and Nigel Farage over the last 12 to 18 months. As many of you know, Farage appeared on BBC's Question Time with no MPs more than Plaid Cymru, the SNP, the Green Party and the DUP combined, despite them having 17 MPs between them. But further than that, Farage has been presented as some sort of alternative and a voice of political dissent, whereas the millions of voices of people who are fighting social injustice and political injustice have been blocked out of the media. The media continues to block out people who are immigrants, black people, young people, unemployed people, working class people. And this is symptomatic of the way the media is going to act in the run-up to the election. They're going to try and control the debate, particularly the billionaire-owned press, which I'm sure Donica will talk about, people like Murdoch, who own The Sun, The Times, Sky, and much, much more. They're going to try and control the debate, the issues that we talk about, and Real Media is aiming to take back that debate and push the issues we care about to the forefront. So just some general announcements. We know that the People's Assembly are holding an event today, which we fully support, and we'll probably be joining them for some drinks afterwards in a pub if you can make it. Oh, thank you. don't worry if you've missed anything. We've got some cameras that are going to be recording, so you'll be able to catch stuff online later. Outside, on the left-hand side, we've got some workshop spaces, which are listed in the piece of paper you might have picked up at the front. And on the right-hand side, we've got a networking space where people can go in and talk to other people, make some connections. We wanted a space where people could chill out, so please go in and check out some of the projects in there. We also have a film showing upstairs from 3 to 5pm, and that's The Condition of the Working Class, along with a Q&A with some of the people behind it. We are providing any lunch, I'm afraid, but there is a library across the road, and there's some food available there if you do get hungry. Coming up from Real Media, we do have an anti-Daily Mail week from the 13th to the 20th of March, which you can find out more about from our Real Media Facebook page and Twitter page, where we've got an Indiegogo fundraiser, so check that out. And then we've also got the full launch of Real Media in April. If you are going to be tweeting today, please use the hashtag Real Media or at Real Media GB. So getting on to this opening plenary, we've got four brilliant speakers with us this morning. Very privileged to have them here. Each of them will be speaking for 8 minutes, and then we've got a 15-minute Q&A. So without further ado, can I introduce Dr. Nafees Ahmed, a best-selling author and award-winning investigative journalist who recently finished a two-part investigation where he broke the exclusive story of how Google was seed-funded by the CIA and the NSA. Do you want me to change it round?
Yeah.
Oops, sorry. Forget that. We're going with Donica first. Donica McCarthy. Sorry, Donica. Donica McCarthy is a broadcaster and journalist on environmental issues. He's the author of several books, including his most recent, The Prostitute State, How Britain's Democracy Has Been Bought. Donica.
Thank you very much, Cam, and thank you very much for the invite to come up to Manchester. I want to do a couple of things today. I want to persuade you, as a former deputy chair of one of Britain's major political parties, that we don't live in a democracy, and we don't live in a liberal democracy. And secondly, I want to persuade you to try and come to London and sit on some concrete for a week. So that's my objective for today. Take a little step back. Why am I here? What's my journey? I'm sure all of you have, if you were up here, you would have equally interesting and relevant stories. In 1992, I was a ballet dancer. I didn't give a damn about the environment, didn't give a damn about politics. I was doing a swallow dive one day on the upper stage, centre stage. My colleagues, not my friends, missed. They hit the deck from 12 foot. I ended up in hospital. My therapist was going to the Amazon. They long story short, I ended up with the Yanomami Indians in the heart of the Amazon Basin by myself without a cell phone. And saw firsthand the destruction of the rainforest, but also became aware of the genocide. A genocide that started when our civilization arrived in the Amazon Basin in the 17th century. There were 6 million people living there then. There's now less than 600,000. And that genocide continues to this day. 28 shamans killed prior to Christmas last year. Came back to Britain, decided, what can I do? Philosophically, I'm a Gandhian. And what I mean by that is I believe that if I am advocating change, I should do it myself. So I decided I need to green my own lifestyle. Started doing that, bought a jar of organic ketchup, my first step. 20 years later, my house is carbon negative. I haven't had a weekly bin collection for waste for 20 years. My gas bill's 12 quid. My electricity bill's zero, basically. My water bill's around £8 other than standing charge per annum. Why am I telling you that? Is it because I'm a smug Irish kid? I am. But I actually want to say that it's important. I think the first step in any activism is putting our own house in order. And I put my house in order, and that's really important. I then got involved in mainstream politics. I got elected as a local councillor, representing the Aylesbury estate, which is in the news at the moment, for the outrageous reason that it's been demolished. I'd put in private homes and losing social housing. Got involved in Local Democrats, became a member of the party's head executive, spent 7 years there, and then became deputy chair of the party for 2 years. I got more policy through in terms of radical policy on environment, transnational corporations, etc., etc., and reforming the party, cleaning up its corruption. I spent 12 years doing that. Very, very successful. Got more stuff through conference than anybody in history of the party. After 12 years, total waste of time. Complete, utter waste of time. Why? Because every single thing that was democratically passed by the conference committee was not implemented by the people who were actually controlling the party, which are the political lobbyists, and the donors and the tax haven people who are actually around the party leadership. So, seeing that from the inside and realizing democracy is broken and corrupted and prostituted, I decided, what can I do? So I left mainstream politics, decided to try and do my environmental activism in a different way. I started writing books about how to live a green lifestyle, advised charities how to be green, had a column in the Independent, spent a huge amount of time trying to persuade people on how to actually buy, if we buy green, we might end up green lobbyists, and help save the planet better. Fast forward to 2011, Occupy asked me to go and talk, and I saw firsthand, Occupy forced me to confront the reality that being a green guru, being a green, encouraging green consumerism, whilst it's important and really it's Gandhian, it wasn't going to have to deal with the issues of the planet and our democracy faces in time. Just two little points. The American government, NASA, has said that the Antarctic ice cap is now melting irreversibly, which means major cities across the world will, in time, be underwater. We have run out of time on climate change. And the other issue is I'm 55 years of age. The circle on this is a very elaborate graphic. Is all of the wildlife, all of the nature that was on the planet when I was born 55 years ago. What I mean by that, all the animals, all the birds, fish, snakes, etc., etc., that were on the planet when I was born. In that time, we have lost 50% of them. We have lost half of nature in less than one person's lifetime. If I live another 30 or 40 years, what are we going to end up with? Other than that graphic. We might end up with maybe 5 or 10% at the rate we're consuming it. We cannot go on as we are. And so therefore I thought, what can I do to actually tackle this? Everything I've done, mainstream politics, green guru, writing, etc., is not doing enough in time. So I decided to write a book about the corruption in our political system so activists like you and alternative media like you could actually know about what the corruption is like from the inside. So I started writing the book 3 years ago, but as I started writing the book and writing about the political corruption, we don't any longer have a political class. We have a political lobbying class. There are 3 pages in the book of senior level Democrats who who were or have been or will be lobbyists. Nick Clegg was a lobbyist. David Laws, the pardon, was a lobbyist. Min Campbell was a lobbyist. The chief executive has gone off to be a lobbyist. I can go on and on and on. We saw from Rifkin and Straw this week, it is endemic. Straw and Rifkin are not the exception, they are the rule. Our political system has been hired by corporate lobbyists. But I realised as I read that there are actually other, I thought there was actually a prostitute state that is going on. And there are four pillars to it. First of all, is a corrupted political system. The second pillar of that prostitute state is our perverted academia. What I mean by that is increasingly our research at universities is being funded by corporate sector. And our think tanks, the left-wing and the centre and right-wing think tanks, which are direct access to our legislative processes, are funded secretively by the corporate billionaire sector. The third pillar, which is what I found really interesting, is that all three major political parties of the last decade have been funded by the tax saving system. Look at the funding of the Labour Party under Blair, the Liberal Democrats, and the Tory Party. Private equity up to its eyeballs, corporate tax savings up to its eyeballs. And that's the third pillar, and that's hugely important in terms of the damage of austerity as a result of that, because actually by the rich not paying their taxes, it means that we are all suffering from having to pay higher taxes and lower public services. And most importantly, the theft from the third world is pouring into British tax savings is one of the biggest stains on the British state. And finally, the final pillar, the most important pillar why we are all here today, of the prostitute state, is the prostituted media. When I started looking at it, I just couldn't believe the stats. 80% of the papers and press that's sold every day in Britain is owned by five right-wing extremist billionaires. And it's not only the press that they own TV companies, they own the HarperCollins, they own the publishing companies, they own the cinema companies, they own the cinema production companies, and even horrifically, they own the press agencies. The Press Association is partly owned by Murdoch, and Reuters is owned by the Thompson family billionaires. So therefore, almost everything that we see, hear, or listen to in our culture is affected by these five billionaires. And so therefore, the prostituted media is the most important pillar of the prostitute state. But if you look at a chair with four legs, if you think that there are four pillars or four legs, if you take one leg out, the chair becomes useless and it topples over. And that's why I believe passionately that the prostituted media is the one that we need to concentrate on. And in the Occupy movement, what we are actually focusing on now is actually we're organising an Occupy Rupert Murdoch Week outside Rupert Murdoch's new glass palace in London Bridge, outside the Shard. He's left his Wapping Fortress in Vernacle, and we're actually there for the week at the end of March, and we want to use that with lots of non-violent direct action and creative protest and discussions and debates, etc., that the Occupy movement specialises in. We want to highlight the reason why you guys are creating an alternative media, and we think that there are three things to finish up, so I'm probably running over time. Am I doing for time?
Yeah.
So, thank you. We think there are three solutions to tackling the prostitute state. First is putting your own house in order. Are you subscribing to Sky? Are you shopping at Sainsbury's? Where are you buying your petrol from? Who are you buying your electricity from? Because if you are doing all of those things, you are funding the lobbyists that are just trashing our democracy. Remember, they have only power because our collective will is giving them our money. Step number one, your own responsibility. Step number two is collective action, creating an alternative press, creating movements, joining political movements, joining relevant NGOs, doing protests, etc. Step number two. But we will not tackle the hijacking of our wealth and the destruction of our planet without mass non-violent direct action across the planet. Unfortunately, it's come to that. I don't want to do it, but it's essential if we're going to do it. We Occupy Democracy has been staging events in Parliament Square, and we're now up to 56 of us have been arrested for peacefully protesting in front of our Parliament. In 4 months, I've been arrested four times for standing in front of our Parliament and peacefully protesting. Once for having a folded sheet of plastic under my arm. The right to peaceful assembly has been taken, so those are the three things you need to do. Self-empowerment, collective action, and non-violent directions action, so peace come to London in the end of March. Thank you very much.
you.
And next we've got Samantha Asumadu, who's a documentary filmmaker and founder of Media Diversified, which is a non-profit independent platform which seeks to promote and cultivate writers of colour, creating challenging new content on inequality and justice. Samantha.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here. I wanted, just before I start, I wanted to actually just follow up on Donica's speech very quickly. And that is to say, if you can, and you're interested in the news, which everybody is, and we're all affected, is to read the book Flat Earth News by Nick Davies. It's a little bit old now. But we, on our platform, which is www.mediadiversified.org, boiled down the points in that book. It's called The 10 Rules of Journalism. It's exactly not what to do, but it's what you should be looking out for. One, run cheap stories. Two, select safe facts. Three, avoid the electric fence, i.e., you know, watch out. Rule four, select safe ideas. Rule five, always give both sides of the story. Rule six, give them what they want, as in us, if we're not critical. Rule seven, the bias against truth. Rule eight, give them what they want to believe in, which is even more needs unpacking, which you can do whenever you've got the time. And then rule nine, go with the moral panic. Rule 10, the Ninja Turtle Syndrome, which is, I don't know how old you are, but I remember Ninja Turtles, and that was when, you know, everybody gets on a bandwagon and you just get complete, you know, saturation within the news about that one story, which we are currently getting with that bloody dress. I don't know if you've seen it or whatever, I don't care about it, but I keep seeing it in my timeline, it's ridiculous. Anyway, so that was, just to follow up, because I thought his speech was fantastic, but I wanted to add that. So I'm going to start. Today I'm going to say a few statistics, but I'm also going to sort of give them a circumference, I don't know. No, give them a grounding with some anecdotes about, just so that they're not, you know, sitting there in this sort of netherworld void, which statistics can sometimes do. So, firstly, between 2009 and 2012, 2,000 BAME people, that term stands for Black and Minority Ethnic People, left the media industry. At the same time, 4,000 more people were employed. So that means for every one black or brown person who left the industry, two white people were employed. And that is stark. In London, where BAME representation in the media industry is at its highest in the country at 8.9%, the overall BAME working population is actually 28.8%. Okay, so to give it some context. So me personally, I'm 35 years old, and I don't look it. But I started in the media industry in 2000 and something. I was a runner for a documentary post house, which did a lot of work with BBC. And you know, I went there so that I could learn how to use broadcast industry standard equipment and editing, and, you know, spend my weekends there. But at the same time, we did a lot of socialising and with the BBC people. And I think at one point, a colleague invited a friend who's at the BBC who recruits. And he, in a very unguarded moment, said that he basically recruits in his own image. You know, white, male, middle class, privately educated, and went to a red brick university. Completely the opposite of me. You know, so I wasn't going to be going to the BBC at any time, I felt. And, you know, and like, I mean, that's going back 13 years. I know they've tried all sorts of diversity measures since then, but we can talk about that another time. Also, what you find is the higher up you go in a corporation, media, or any other industry, the whiter it gets. I'm sure you've noticed. And the BBC and others, but they're less obvious about it in some ways. They love employing interns, with black and Asian interns, but, you know, they rarely see you as professionals. So all those people that left the industry, where did they go to? You know. So basically, I left that industry after maybe about 8 months. I couldn't see a way forward. There was no opportunities. And I went to work for a financial PR company after that. It was really strange, doing events. But what was good about that is my lovely old boss, actually, you know, we're still friends, and he donated 12 bottles of wine to a launch party. Anyway, so, but I got another job in the media 2 years later, but that was through nepotism, which is strange for a black person in the media industry. You don't get to use that as much as you have to until we have a meritocracy. Which then
as many opportunities as everybody else. You're white, middle class, privately educated, blah, blah, blah. You know, so a friend of mine who I'd gone to uni with sort of set me up in a job at Sky News Showbiz. Well, actually, I was doing videos interviewing, like, you know, three people a week, such as Jordan, you know, Katie Price, blah, 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 blah. So really challenging stuff. But, you know, like, quite often nowadays, so I'm talking about, you know, 8 or so years ago, nowadays you have to do internships generally to get into the media through economic downturn, blah, 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 blah. And so how do working class black and Asian and white working class people manage to fund themselves through the media? To get into the media, it's very difficult. So I actually moved to Uganda in 2007, where I was initially working for a local production company. And then, long story short, I did my first documentary for Al Jazeera English in 2009, which they broadcast then. I would never have been able to make a documentary in London that, you know, where I was given a $30,000 budget to do what I wanted to do with the film that I did, which is about three Ugandan rally drivers, women rally drivers. So, you know, that is quite drastic, having to move to another country. And you can ask me, oh, but are you from Uganda? No, my family are from Ghana, so I went to an East African country. But the thing is, at the same time, after that, you get noticed, so I started doing breaking news for CNN, so I covered the Kampala bombings, landslides, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, as a black Westerner in Africa, I had a lot more opportunities than the local people who had far more expertise and more knowledge than that. Because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, CNN thought, wow, we've got a black girl, she's got a British accent, still an African name, let's put her on the telly. It's ridiculous. Yeah, and so that is certainly a problem. I just lost my way. Let me see. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, CNN... So I said, I mentioned the Kampala bombings. So I didn't actually want to cover it, but they asked me, and they kind of made me do it. But the next day, they flew in their correspondent from Kenya, where they're based, and he's a tall, white, privately educated, red, blah, 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 blah. And you know, and most of their senior staff in that region are. Whereas you could have got, like, you've got Reuters and AP who do actually have black Ugandan or Sudanese correspondents there. And then, so that is a problem. I mean, even CNN actually called me in 2012, I was back in London by then, and asked me to, you know, give expert comment on Kony. It's like, what? I've moved back to London. For one, I'm not Ugandan, I've never met Kony. So I gave him a list of people, come on, you know, I'm getting the red card. So diversity for the media is about image, it's not about substance. I mean, last year I was called by ITN to ask if I'd go on Channel 4 News to talk about the situation in the Central African Republic. I've never been there, I don't know anything about it. Ridiculous. But they literally said, we want a black woman to talk about CAR. Not me. Anyway, so problems with the media industry also. So after I got all these chances, I got a commission for Deutsche Welle to go to Congo, where I did a story about blood minerals, basically DNA fingerprinted of blood minerals. However, these people were unwilling to insure me. Basically, my first trip to Congo, they said, well, we'll pay you per minute for footage. We can't really properly commission you because, you know, if you die, we can't take responsibility for you. I mean, that's my first trip to Congo, and that's the advice I get from broadcasters. So, yeah, it's a harsh industry. So, but, you know, I mean, I took my chances. I was very lucky. I was born in South London, black, working class, still live in the council estate. I was just lucky, I was a bit sort of foolish and whatever. But I'm coming to my conclusion. Coming through all these experiences, I realised I needed to create a platform for black writers. A platform we controlled to put out stories from established and up-and-coming black writers. But directly, without the filter of white-dominated mainstream media. And so through my experiences, I saw black writers who were basically being exploited by the system, often not paid for their work, you know, forever interns. And so we established Media Diversified as a platform, but also an experts directory, which launches next week, filled with all sorts of experts, black and brown experts. You know, I've got gynecologists in there, barristers, all sorts. And it launches next week, and we will disrupt the stale, male, pale media landscape. Thank you very much.
Next we've
got Des Friedman, who's an author and professor of media and communications at Goldsmiths College. He's also chair of the Media Reform Coalition and on the National Committee of for the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom. Des.
Thank you for being here. And I definitely don't want to speak from the perspective of perverted academia. It's a great chance not to be able to do that, but much more as a media activist. And I wanted to start with the question of inequality, because we all know what a huge problem we have with inequality. You just think about what happens in London when these multi-million pound homes for the rich are snapped up within a couple of seconds, where at the same time, 4 in 10 households in this country are too poor to participate adequately in society. We know the Oxfam figures that we're just about to get to the stage where 1% of the world's population control 50% of the world's wealth. Britain, is it any different? Well, the 100 richest families in Britain have the same wealth as the so-called bottom, the poorest 30% of households. You're talking 100 families as wealthy as around 20 million people. Now, those are stark and horrific figures about inequality, but we have huge inequality, not surprisingly, in the media. We have the same concentration of power, wealth and resources that we see in other areas of our life, reflected and structuring the kind of media that we have. So it's not just about the banking. It's not just about concentration in big pharma. It's not just about concentration in supermarkets. We have this problem across the media. You will know all the figures. You've already heard some. These are figures that you wouldn't be allowed to get away with in some areas of public life. Three companies, mostly offshore, controlling 70% of daily circulation. One company, Sky, provides all the news for commercial radio. You have one company dominating pay TV. And is the online world any better? Well, it provides us certainly with opportunities. But actually, you think about Google's share, 92% of search. Think of Amazon's complete domination of e-books. You see these patterns of concentration reflected across both the online and offline world. Yet we're told that we have a free media, that we should celebrate. In fact, we're lectured to by the Daily Mail and the Sun, in their opinion, columns the whole time, about the wonders of a free media. Well, I guess it's true at some levels. It certainly allows those companies to be free to attack immigrants, to attack women, to attack benefit claimants for being scroungers. It certainly leaves them free to support the wars of occupation, the wars for oil that we continue to have. So it's a particular kind of freedom. It's freedom for the owners, and it produces a system that does not represent us, not in this room, not across the country, for reasons that you have already heard. It doesn't look like us, it doesn't speak our language, it doesn't address the issues that we need to know about. And far from being this liberal idea of the media being a check on power, it is way too, it's part of that vested interest. It's completely connected to the most powerful interest in this country. One pretty obvious example, if we had a completely free media, how is it, perhaps it's just a coincidence, that there was only one title that was able to articulate the nearly 50% of people in Scotland who voted for independence? Is that a mistake? Is that an accident? Or is there something structurally wrong about the distribution of power inside the media? But the good news is, and I hope there'll be some good news today. A lot of it is, it's a bad starting point, but the fact that we're here is a positive step. But there is good news, which is, more by and large, we do not trust these people anymore, if we ever did. Not surprising, a system that treats Nigel Farage as a genuine counterweight to Labour and the Tories. A system that celebrated the stock markets and financial transactions as beneficial for everyone leading up to the 2008 crash. A system which never really called or investigated the role of bankers in causing that crash. A system that systematically, to this day, and infuriatingly, underrepresents anti-austerity views all the time. One academic survey found that, looking at the opinion columns of some of the elite newspapers, and it found that 60% of the voices quoted were mainstream economists. A giant 1% were from trade unionists who might have something to say about austerity and how we should resist it. So not surprisingly in all of this, that we are starting or continuing not to trust the media system. It's something like 20% of the British population trust journalists. It's just above politicians and just above estate agents. And that is not a great place to be. I prefer to be able to trust journalists, but it's not until we get a system that tells us what we need to know, tells us the truth, is independent from vested interests, that we will ever be able to trust them. So what we need is a media that talks like us, that talks like the population it's supposed to represent, and that tackles the real problems we face, not Madonna falling down the stairs, not, you know, the obsession with London Fashion Week and things like that. So I draw on the work of some great Canadian media activists who organise an event just like this once a year in Vancouver. So you should get over to Vancouver to bring the solidarity greetings. And it's Media Democracy Day in Canada once a year. And their slogan is very simple, which is know the media, be the media, change the media. And in a way, that is exactly what today is about, trying to get to grips with our understanding of what has gone wrong. It's clearly reflecting all the incredible efforts of people who are the media, who are alternative, although we should resist that kind of voice because it makes them sound legitimate and us sound like the fringe when that's clearly not the case. But we also need to think about how to change the media. And I just think we need all forms of action together with producing our own forms of media. We need to work with others all the time to tackle and confront and call for action to challenge the abuse of media power. And that's a lot of different things. So that's whether that is direct action in the way that Donika's been talking about, whether that is direct action, working with others around making, it's a pretty popular slogan, I would suggest, around making the Googles, Facebooks, Amazons pay the tax that they have been long avoiding. We need to work with others to demand the ownership limits so that no single company should grow too large and too powerful for our craven politicians never to dare to stand up to. We need to work with others all the time to demand that newspapers that tailor their content to suit advertisers like HSBC, that they should be punished, that this is not an acceptable way of behaving in a so-called liberal democracy. We need to make, over the next couple of months, I think, and it's going to be a pretty hard task, we need to make media ownership and the need for structural ownership reform an election issue. It's a scandal that only one party, the Greens, have embraced decent ownership reform in there. I hope it'll be in their manifesto. They certainly passed policy at their conference. But will any of the other parties either be interested in or be brave enough to stand up to the media moguls and call for something that we know will be a popular demand across this country, which is about standing up to bullies and standing up to people who don't pay taxes and so on? Well, we will see. If you're interested in how the election is being covered by the corporate media, I strongly suggest you look up a website called Election Unspun, which provides beautiful images of how the election is being covered. And you will see that the kind of presidentialisation is pretty endemic. It is about Farage, it is about Cameron, it is about a handful of individuals and not about the real issues of poverty, inequality and so on. And the final point really is just to say that campaigning works. What we do can make a difference, because if we don't do it, sure as hell, no one else is going to do it on our behalf. I don't know what your views are on the work done by No More Page 3. It hasn't got rid of sexism in the world. But the fact is, it raised that issue about how women should be represented. And it was a pretty powerful argument that still needs to be, you know, it's still ongoing. But just a couple of days ago, we had what I think is a pretty amazing victory. Am I allowed to use the word victory? Whenever you say the word victory, you think you're going to crash the next day. But in America, a huge public campaign composed of many millions of people working online and offline overturned the very rich lobbyists of some of the most powerful telecoms and cable companies and forced the Federal Communication Commission, by no means a left-wing organisation, to stand up for network neutrality, for net neutrality, and to make sure that the corporations aren't able to just divide up if you want to use the old metaphor of the superhighway into a fast and a slow lane. That still is, we have a lot of work to do, but that was through sheer, persistent, energetic campaigning of the sort that we need. So I think that's what today is about, working with each other, celebrating the kind of work that media activists are doing, strategising, making sure that we're on the streets of London, finding the best ways At the same time as producing our own stories and narratives, we also do need to work together to tackle the concentrated media power that, as far as I can see, has been absolutely instrumental in sustaining the terrible inequalities that have wrecked so many lives. So it's a hell of a job to do, but today is obviously a fantastic start. Thank you very much.
For giving my premature introduction for Nafees. Once again, he's the best-selling author and award-winning investigative journalist who broke the story on Google being seed funded by the CIA and the NSA, and that was funded through his new crowd-funded project, InSearch. Nafees.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me here. Lot to talk about. I'm not really sure where to begin. How many of you are familiar with my experience at The Guardian? So I'll start by talking about what happened to me at The Guardian, and then we can kind of go into some of the issues that have been discussed. So I've kind of been a kind of freelance journalist, academic type for about just over a decade or so. Long hard slog, nearly 2 years ago now, I got a gig at The Guardian. Before, I was writing for places like The Independent, New Statesman, blah, 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 blah. So I got this gig at The Guardian writing for the environment section. And I was quite fortunate. I had a blog which I could basically publish straight to. I had editorial freedom under my contract. And my background is in international security. So I was commissioned to write about the geopolitics of the environment. And when I was hired along with a team of environment bloggers. So the idea was that they would get all of these bloggers and they'd all be kind of writing about their different areas of specialism. It was a really cool thing. So I was putting out stories about, which tried to kind of go beyond the traditional kind of way in which the environment is viewed and look at how things which we don't necessarily see the environment in, the environment is definitely there. And as we know, the environment is everywhere. You know, everything is about the environment, about energy, about economics, and all of these things are ultimately deeply intertwined. So I was talking about things like Syria, Iraq, the rise of ISIS, what's going on in Ukraine, and piecing it all together and showing how these issues like environmental crisis, geopolitics were all intimately interconnected. And that was all fine. Then I decided to write about Gaza. And, Operation Protective Edge started. And when I had applied to The Guardian, in my portfolio was a story I had done for Le Monde Diplomatique on the previous Operation Cast Lead. And in that, I had spoken about how Moshe Yaalon, who is now the defense minister in Israel, had written a policy paper just a year before the operation talking about the need to basically have a military operation in Gaza to remove Hamas, and that would be the only way to access untapped gas fields in the Gaza Marine, which basically the British company, the British BG Group, had rights to that field, and Tony Blair, the Middle East envoy, had been busily pursuing peace by attempting to allow Israel to get access to this gas and trying to broker a deal, which, you know, once Hamas was elected in 96, kind of scuppered that process. So I decided to write about this stuff that was going on in Gaza and the gas issues and the new kind of competition that was going on. And I wrote a piece contextualizing what was going on in Gaza. Certainly wasn't trying to make the case that everything going on in Gaza was about gas or about energy, which would be totally reductionist. But it was increasingly an important issue in understanding the dynamic of the conflict and its direction. I got a call the next day from one of my senior editors. And by the way, the account of this, you can probably Google it and find it very easily. I went public and I put it online, and you can read a very detailed account of all of this. He called me up, James Randerson at The Guardian, and he said to me, Nafees, I'm sorry to say, but this is not a proper environment story. And we're going to have to discontinue your blog. I was like, what the fuck? What? What are you talking about? I mean, that was literally, it was just like, this is just, it just came totally out of the blue. So that was my experience of censorship. And then obviously, I mean, once that happened, I mean, they literally, within the hour, they actually, you know, their rights manager contacted me and terminated my contract. And they did it illegally. They didn't have the right. Now, for me as a journalist at that point, you know, I was a lowly, you know, kind of effectively a freelance blogger with a freelance contract with The Guardian. You know, and in that position as a journalist, you're kind of like, do I want to destroy my relationship with The Guardian completely? You know, what is going on here? You know, what do I try to negotiate? You find yourself in this situation where you really do not know what to do. So I spent a month speaking to various people, trying to understand what happened, confused about what to do, not sure whether I should take legal action or not, if it was even worth doing. I mean, I was talking to some journalists who were like, if you try to take them to a tribunal, you'll probably never write for The Guardian again. And I was like, oh God, God forbid I can never write for The Guardian again. And that's kind of what I was thinking at the time. I mean, in the end, I reached, to cut a long story short, I reached a decision where I decided that I didn't need to worry about my relationship with The Guardian, and I preferred to go public. So, I mean, what that illustrates, I mean, there wasn't a lobby. This was not the Israel lobby or something. This was The Guardian. I spoke to journalists who told me that there was a culture, journalists inside The Guardian, who said there's a culture at The Guardian of being this kind of pro-Zionist culture that had been established since the newspaper's inception. And what the argument was not that there was a big structural kind of, not that there was a kind of set editorial line, but rather that there were kind of invisible walls that editors would kind of know that there are certain things which basically we just really don't talk about. What you'll notice is that before I wrote about Gaza's gas in the context of war and Israel's wars, military operations, there was not a single article in The Guardian that had ever discussed this issue in that context. And there probably won't be a single one afterwards. That article on Gaza was the most popular, and is today the most popular article on Gaza ever on The Guardian website. And it's just like had some ridiculous, it just went nutty viral, went crazy amount of shares. And yet that's how they dealt with it. So why? Why are we facing this, you know, strange kind of, I mean, we've seen over the last couple of weeks with the HSBC scandal and Peter Oborne's revelations about the Telegraph, and then we've seen the ensuing farce where the Telegraph then starts running exposés of medium. The Guardian is, they didn't run something because Apple said don't run it. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how plausible some of those things are, given the Telegraph's, the politicisation of the Telegraph's desire to expose these things. I think some of them do seem plausible, some of them perhaps less so. And then, you know, then we had the smug responses of The Guardian. Look at the Telegraph. Look what they're saying. It's ridiculous. we're The Guardian. We're owned by the Scott Trust. And that was kind of funny because Owen Jones, who's, you know, a lot of respect for Owen Jones. He's a great journalist and he does great stuff. Wrote a naive little column pontificating about the brilliance of The Guardian and how The Guardian is owned by the Scott Trust and therefore it's much more independent. And what he didn't say is that the Scott Trust is not a trust. The Scott Trust in 2008 was changed into a limited company, like any other limited company, a profit-making company. So I think there's a lot of this kind of mythical stuff about The Guardian and the liberal kind of media. And it's what we're now realising, and I think has been made very clear here, is that there isn't a huge amount of difference. I do think The Guardian and The Independent can be somewhat better in their coverage sometimes, purely because of their ideological leanings, perhaps. But there's a huge amount of stuff that is not being covered. I'm right now working on another story about HSBC and how HSBC has ripped off consumers in Britain to the tune of something like $1 billion of fraud. And every single media company in Britain has suppressed this story. So there's been a lot of this kind of like, look, we covered HSBC. Mm. Amazing. But no one covered this story in Britain, and there are political reasons for that, because of the implications of exposing HSBC's operations in Britain and the massive ramifications that could have on HSBC's ability to operate in Britain and the United States, and the reverberations that could have around the finance community in terms of the demand for regulation and accountability. What I want to do, what I want to close by saying, is the reason I think we're seeing a clampdown in the way the media is operating recently is because of the crisis that we're facing. We've heard about the environmental crisis. We've heard about the crisis of inequality. We've heard about the crisis in politics and the corruption. And all of these crises are part of the same problem, which is fundamentally our planet is owned and controlled by a tiny minority of people who are exploiting the commons for their own benefit to maximise concentrations of wealth. And in the process, they're raping the planet, sending us down to this path of suicidal annihilation. In that context, however, the system is dying. Everything that we see happening now is not from a position of strength, and it can sometimes seem like that when you're looking on the outside from where we are, but it's actually happening from a position of increasing and escalating weakness. In every possible sector you look at, when you look at fossil fuels, when you look at the environmental sector, when you look at the banking sector, what we're seeing here is a crumbling, dying system. What we saw in 2008 was only the beginning of that. We're going to see more financial crises. We've seen ongoing austerity and economic slowdown. The recovery has been not a recovery at all. And that kind of problem is escalating. The people who run the show are worried. They're worried that as these crises escalate, and as many documents and planning documents show, they are worried what happens when those crises hit and people go out on the streets, because they know that people are going to get angry. And that's why it's even more important for them to create these narratives that divide people along race, religion, ethnicity, because they need us to be pointing fingers at each other and not at them. And that is why the gathering like this is so critically important, because whatever it takes, the solution is going to be information. Because one of the key things that came out in my Google story was that the whole reason they have been co-opting tech companies like Google and Facebook is control of information. It's the last thing that they have, apart from military power. Military power, information control, that is the plank of war today. So we need to have an information revolution. We need to basically begin to create new narratives, new visions of what society can look like. And we need to be able to empower people with the realization that the highways of information, even though there is an effort to control them, are inherently and increasingly decentralized. And in a sense, these guys are fighting a losing battle. So I'd just like to basically say it's a pleasure to be here and be part of this conference. And I'm pretty sure that we have an opportunity here to plant the seeds of something that can take the system on once and for all. Thank you very much.
So we're going to have a 10-minute, just over 10-minute Q&A. So if you'd like to put your hand up if you've got a question, I'll take them in groups of three. So if you go one, two, three at the back there for this round. I'll get you in, Samantha. Could you stand up? When you're maybe, sorry.
Hi. You said about systems like being already dying, and if you look at the media and the relevance of it in its current format, just isn't there anymore. So when we sent the press release, I send it, but I always put it on the blog first. That way we can contrast what did you leave out. And that tells us more than what they put in. And also at the point where we have such a poor relationship with our local newspaper that I would direct them to the blog rather than even send them a press release, because they're just going to completely ruin it and not take the right information out anyway. And again, go to the comments on the stories that they do and put the full press release in that so that people can see what the truth and reality was. But then also, like, you look at individual journalists who are doing fabulous work and wonder, how does that work? How do you see the future for media in the sense that, like, I go to Twitter, I have a list called Trusted Journalists. So when I want to read my day's news, I go to that list. Bad and biased is much longer and a lot of fun, but it's just not going to give you anything good. But how do you group, and is there a need to group? Is there a need for titles and publications still? And how does that work when it's full of individuals we trust, you know, that we learn to trust because you've not let us down yet? And how does that work, and how does it look for the media in the future?
That's that question. yeah, just very quickly, I'll just, I mean, I think, in my view, I think you're absolutely right in terms of the decline of the media. It's one of the things that we're seeing is that, it's a matter of fact, I mean, look, I actually don't pick up a newspaper in print anymore. You know, it's all going to be looking online, Google, blah, blah, blah. I don't think many of us will buy physical newspapers. I mean, even people who are much older than me and are used to, like, they like doing crosswords and things, like, they'll tell me, you know, they might buy the Sunday paper or the weekend or on the weekend, but not even during the week. So print is declining in that sense. But more than that, it's like my kids, they just don't, well, they will never read a newspaper. They it's just going to be online. And they're not, and not even just online, it's going to be on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. That's where they're seeing the stuff that interests them. So there is this decentralization and fragmentation going on, and people are looking for what they want. That can be problematic in a way, in the sense that, you know, for us, in terms of a challenge of how do we insert ourselves into that? But I think we're looking at this, there is this massive transition, and what you're seeing is all of these big conglomerates in so many different ways. When I mentioned, like, fossil fuels, the banking sector, the media sector, all of them are facing massive challenges across the board. You know, conventional banking is facing problems from things like Bitcoin, all these kind of new electronic ways of doing transactions and all the rest of it. Whatever the pitfalls of these things are accelerating massively and out of their control. It's the same with the media. There is a massive opportunity here for us to be able to create credible, people-owned. And I think the key thing here is about people having ownership. People are pissed off with the media because they know that we don't have any stake in this. But if there is something like real media or whatever that people have a stake in, that's where they'll go. And I think that's the key. I mean, I think what we'll see in the next couple of years is finding new ways to use technology to team up, have journalists work together using crowdfunding, using digital technologies to find new ways to create interesting platforms. And I think it's a really exciting time, and the opportunity is here, and all we need to do, and I think lots and lots of people are already taking that opportunity.
Samantha, and then
yeah, I just want to say every word you said was fantastic. Every single word. If you send out press releases and so on, do exactly what this woman did. What is your publication?
No, we're Fight Fracking and Fun Bonfire.
What's your blog?
It's the Nana's Residents Against Bar Fracking.
Okay, you should go and look at her. You should look at her website. It sounds fantastic. But I just wanted to come on to that and say that we, as an organisation, started a hashtag on Twitter a couple of days ago, and it's called The Trashies. It is the newspaper equivalent of the Razzies in Hollywood. It's inspired by two columns that were published earlier this week, one by Grace Dent in the Independent, and one by, actually two by Emma Varner in the Telegraph, the second of which she called us fake this, phone this, blah, 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 blah. Literally, and she didn't mention me by name, but she did say, and some of you said I'm not qualified to talk about ISIS, which at that point I sent her the bio of a terrorism expert called Rashid Singh, who is very much qualified compared to Emma Bonner. We are using this hashtag to highlight bad columns that have been published since 2013, because we want the media to fix up, as in stop punching down and stop getting things wrong. And we think by highlighting bad journalism in all its varying forms, and they will, I mean, our account on Twitter, we've got hundreds of journalists that follow us, like the editor of The Guardian, everybody anyway. And so people will read that hashtag, we'll certainly get trashed ourselves about it, but like highlight bad examples of journalism and show this, you should not be replicating that. The second point I want to make is to Nafees. That HSBC article sounds fantastic. I'd love to have it on our platform, and we'll pay you more than The Guardian would.
Sorry.
I'm just wondering about my work with radio, and I was thinking about what you were saying, and it strikes me it's very difficult to try and give free information about what's going on, because of Ofcom regulations. especially like a year like this where sort of election, the control Ofcom has over what can go out is very stringent. Their claims about can you have to be balanced and so on. So I just wanted to ask the panel like what advice, how can we get around those sort of problems, or is there a solution, or do we need to get a change in the regulations itself?
Des?
Do you want to take more questions or come straight back?
Okay, can we just take your question really quickly?
Okay, I'll skip the point. I was going to make a quick point about lobbying. As you know, a few years ago, the chief Tory treasurer was caught peddling influence for £100,000. Every single policy and act of parliament should now be, the first question any journalist should ask is, who's bribed for this? Who's lobbied for this? Okay? They call it cash for access. It's not a policy for sale. Cash for access is a disinfo term, okay? But my question was actually, every journalist I meet, I ask them if they read about the news. Most of them haven't. And most of them, when I talk to them about this and that and the other, not learning anything from it, but they do seem to be not massively up on kind of world events, economy and history. My question is, what's actually going on at graduate level and postgraduate level in journalism schools? Is it that they're just taught how to interview and how to edit, but like what's going on in the world is like, well, that doesn't matter?
Well, they're not at Goldsmiths, I can promise you that. In terms of objectivity and impartiality, it's a tricky question because objectivity is used as a deliberate strategy to confuse, to distort, so that you just have objectivity. It depends where you start from. The objective cover of Israel and Palestine assumes so much that, you know, you take the position of, you know, you set up the camera inside Israel, and then that's the starting point, and it's a completely kind of skewed objectivity. On the other hand, we don't want, that we know there's a lot of pressure to get rid of the broadcast rules on impartiality because a lot of people, very powerful people, want a fox. They want the foxification of our broadcasting. So it's quite a tricky argument. I think you just have to use your ingenuity, use the passion, use the most, the voices that you have access to just to make their case. But first of all, I don't see, you know, Ofcom is going to come crashing down you at a time like this. You know, I hope I'm not wrong. But the fact is that, you know, your biggest strength will be just giving expression to people whose voices are kept off the airwaves. And if they want to come for you, well, there's people in the room who are going to support you. The second point I wanted to make was just about the opportunity of digital. It is true, I guess it's trying to come back on you, Nafis. The opportunities for us presented by digital are clearly there. But let's face it, the opportunities are also there for giant corporations. It may be true that fewer and fewer people read the printed press, but just because you get a story from Instagram, just because it's, you know, you get it through Facebook, it does not mean that the source of that story is not the Mail. The Mail has used these technologies just as much, well, more than you've been able to make itself the world's most popular online newspaper. And even if it is the case that they are a dying breed, a dying animal, we know that wounded animals can be quite dangerous. So I wouldn't in any way want the consequence of what you're saying be to suggest that media power is some, you know, is on the wane because we have these new technologies. The fact is that the press releases you're talking about, it is true that it helps good activists to demonstrate the lack of objectivity inside the corporate media, but it also allows for journalism, precisely the kind of thing that Samantha was talking about from Nick Davis, which is the fact that we know quantitatively that an astonishing amount of our daily newspapers are filled with direct reproductions of press releases. So it's a battle, and there's nothing inevitable about who's going to win despite social media.
Okay. Yeah, just about the future of the media. I think it's really important to realise that the web is not the answer to all our problems. As you just said, 70% of the news hits already are to the billionaire press online. So, and that's growing. The only major news outlets online that are successful are BBC and The Guardian. They have a bigger presence there than they do in the printed press. So it's a little bit better than the printed world, but the billionaire press are gradually getting there. I would like to just make an appeal that we stop using the phrase, talk about the future of the press. Let's stop calling, referring to it, as somebody else said, there isn't, the mainstream press is not the mainstream press. The mainstream press is a right-wing extremist billionaire press. It's a long phrase, but it's useful. But I remember every time you refer to the mainstream press, you are giving away our power. You're saying 5 billionaires are the mainstream. It's only 5 people. We can take them on. There's 60 million of us. Let's win.